Mahaprana Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Shamavita Bhaktivinda Ki Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bho. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Srila Prabhupada, the Mam Vishnu Paraya, Krishna Prashtaya, Bhutalaya, Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Nitya Namini. Namaste, Sarasvati Devi, Gauravani Vicharani, Nevishesha Shunya Vadi Prashachade Satarani. Hare Krishna. So welcome again. Today, Nitai Gauranga Prabhu, as they say, phoned in sick. So he won't be taking part in today's class. I'll go see him later, see how he's doing. And, yes.
Thank you.
Maharaji, that one may not work. These things have their way of. You can try it. Otherwise, try this one. You have to pass it around to everybody. Okay. These things unfortunately have their way of quitting. These nozzles on top. So a few practical things. Is that the class, this portion of the class will, last day will be on Wednesday, because they're going to, on Thursday, go to the Yoga Peeth as the first step of the Parikram. And all the boys here, the staff of the school, will be going on that, so we'll have our last day on Wednesday, and we will resume on the 10th. Of this month, March, again. I spoke with Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj. Of course, it doesn't look like today. Oh, here we are. Oh, yes. Our very faithful Shantiparayan Prabhu and his wife are here. That's great. So anyway, especially for them. May I ask, how many, you're resident here in Mayapur? Maharaji, and you? You stay here? Okay. And yourself?
Hungary.
Oh, you're from Hungary. Okay. But Shanti and his wife stay here. I don't know. Today the madness begins. The transit of madness. So I don't know if we'll have our normal group with us, because also other seminars are being started now. But here's Shanti and wife. We were just talking about the future of this course. We're going to end this portion of it. Wednesday will be the last day, and we'll start it up again on the 10th. So I was just talking with Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj, because there's still so much material to be covered. And Nitai Gauranga plans to stay here for a year, the coming year. So we may just continue with this class, you know, even after the festival.
In the afternoons.
Yeah, just as long as we have material to cover. Because it's not going to be fair to try to squeeze. That's like 3 days plus 4 days. Well, anyway, we'll see what we can do, but a lot would have to be cut out to squeeze everything into it, into just that short time period. So we want to develop a full adult education program here. So we've just started to work on a Bhakti Shastri course, just planning it. So in the meantime, we can have this class in the afternoon until we get a Bhakti Shastri class together. We have all the, actually, it shouldn't take us long to do that. We have all the material collected. So, our normal mode of starting is to answer any questions that you might have. Anyone have any questions from, let me see, persons who are just here for the first day, devotees? All right. So as I mentioned, today we will go into the reply of the Hamsa Avatar. So as you will remember, the theme of this part of our presentation of Science and Mind is relationship and attachment. Actually, relationship is very fundamental to the mind. The mind is said to basically have a dualistic function. Technically in Sanskrit it's called sankalpa vikalpa, or accepting and rejecting. So that means relating. First of all, the mind has to relate to whatever it may accept or reject. And it relates to perceptions. But as we've already explained, perceptions are of two kinds. They're the kind that are brought to the mind from outside through the senses. And then there are the kind coming up from inside in the form of memories, which are deeply rooted in samskaras, previous impressions, that even from previous lifetimes. Sometimes we have some odd, very odd, strange, unusual mental image pop into our mind, particularly when we dream at night. And when we get to Ramanujacharya's explanation of how the mind works, we'll see that these dreams are coming out of smriti, out of memory, and that does not necessarily mean the memories of just this lifetime. So this is how impressions come into the mind, or relations, the mind's relations with other things. They can be external, or they can be wholly internal. But in any case, their mind is relating to something. And then the mind concludes either this is a pleasant experience, I like this, I want more of this, or this is bad, stop it. Sankalpa, vikalpa. So relationship then is basically a mental phase of existence. And attachment, of course, jetu visya pungsa sangas teshu pajayate sangat sanjayate kama. Krishna explains this in the second chapter of Gita. First we contemplate the objects of the senses, again, either externally or internally. And what follows is that the mind becomes attached to them. And from that attachment, lust develops. And in third chapter, Lord Krishna, he describes this lust as nitya vairanam, the eternal enemy of the soul. It's this lust that is the very principle of our bondage. And so as devotees, persons who are endeavoring to go back home, back to Godhead, then this becomes our principal obstacle. Lust in its different forms. Of course, we know there are subtle forms of lust. It was mentioned in a Bhagavatam class recently, the nice class that Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj gave, I believe it was him, who was saying that profit, adoration, distinction, I think it was mentioned in the purport, these are subtle forms of lust. So, and as you've already heard, for those who arrive late, Nitai Gauranga will not be here today because he's sick, but when he was talking about Freud, of course, there are many bad things to say about Sigmund Freud. He was an atheist and all that. But Prabhupada did emphatically agree with one of Freud's bottom lines, one of the bottom lines of Freudian psychology, and that is that in the material world, the underlying motivation of what everyone is doing is sex. But as we find Krishna explains in Gita, raga dvesha, icha dvesha. You see, raga means attraction, sexual attraction. Icha means desire, sexual desire. That is inseparable from something called dvesha, which means enviousness. You see? That is naturally involved in sexual relationships. That, anyway, we don't have to go into detail. I think everyone is sufficiently aware of these things. But Prabhupada talks about the grihamedis, for example, as opposed to grihastas, who live a life centered around Krishna. The grihamedis are those householders who live a life centered around sex, and Prabhupada says, calls them envious householders, because of their having no restriction in sexual, they actually think that the whole point of marriage is sex. So therefore, you see these nice little neighborhoods, everything externally looking very orderly, and externally everyone seems to be very content. But every house is a little fortress. And I remember when I grew up, you see, when we'd sit down at the table, and then my father and mother would just always in the course of conversation start talking about some neighbors or others and how off the wall they are, you know, how they don't know how to take care of their yard, or their kids are crazy, or something or other, you know. So this is the meaning of grihamedi. They may all live in one nice neighborhood together and all seem like friends chatting over the back fence. But underneath all that, they're very envious of one another. And if someone in the neighborhood takes a daring step, like it gets a brand new car, brand new flashy car, then everyone else is talking about it. And of course, the first reaction is, oh, you know, they have no taste in cars, that's a terrible car. But then gradually you start to see everybody else in the neighborhood also gets a new car. Because they have to keep up. So that's, that enviousness is expressed as competition. We have this phrase in a common American talk, it's very appropriate, keeping up with the Joneses. Jones is a very common name in the United States. Mr. Jones. So keeping up with the Joneses means like your neighbors may be the Joneses. So you have to, whatever they're doing, you have to keep up with that. There's always this competition. So you can't let yourself fall too far behind them, you know. So that's what it means. Griha media. So relationship and attachment, that's the subject. And we followed this, traced this back to the mental processes and the relationship of the mind to the senses. And we found this interesting duality, or we also explained this big fancy word, complementarity from quantum physics, because the problem is cropping up everywhere in psychology and science, that there is this duality between the inner self and the outer world. It's a duality, yet it's a complementarity, because it's a duality because obviously we have this sense of ourselves. I exist as an individual, and somehow I'm inside here. We all feel like that, even people who are not devotees. They talk about the inner life of the mind. As I said it the other day, we're all glad that, in one sense, that we're covered by these gross material bodies, and that people can't see our subtle bodies, because it would be very embarrassing for us, you know. If everyone could see your subtle body as easily as they could see your gross body, we'd be very embarrassed. And that's why Prabhupada compared the gross body to the overclothes and the subtle body to the underclothes. Nobody wants to be seen walking around just in their underclothes. So there's this obviously the self is inside, yet the self's relationship with everything else is outside. Even other selves, they're outside. And so we require the senses, and the senses are perceiving this world. And then from out of this, that is the original duality. There's a famous French philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre. He was one of the existentialists of the 20th century, big name. And one of his famous sayings, aphorisms, was a definition of hell. It shows how cynical he was. Hell is other people, he said. Because that's where all the difficulties are in life, relating with other people. So hell is other people. So we don't like being alone. We have to have relationships, but all the relationships are out there, and out there there are so many problems, you see. Other people, yes, but birth, death, disease, old age, so many, many problems. And there's a problem in the very relationship between internal and external. Where does the internal end and the external begin? That question of subjectivity means what I think myself, my own idea of things, and objectivity, the way things really are. That's one of the big problems of philosophy, of non-Vedic philosophy, Western, so-called Western philosophy, European philosophy, contemporary philosophy. That's one of the big questions. Is everything just mind? You see, is everything just a product of my imagination? That could be. It's a kind of insane conclusion, but it might be for all we are able to scientifically prove. That's what we showed in that film. For those of you who saw that film, you see that science leads us inevitably to that conclusion. This is where science goes. Therefore I said the other day that science is actually like that big mythical serpent that is eating itself, you know. You've probably seen that. It's got its own tail in its mouth, and it's eating itself. Because whatever science discovers, proves, establishes, undermines itself. So that was so clear in that film, that the science of perception, the science of neurology, brain functions, tends to come to the conclusion that there is no external world, that everything is just happening inside our own brain. And there may or may not be an external world. The very fact that we dream at night, we go to sleep and we dream at night, our senses are shut down, and yet we're living in another world when we're dreaming. And those experiences, when we're having them, they're real to us. You see, of course, when we wake up, then we say, oh, it was only a dream. But when we're in the middle of it, that's reality, you see. And there's no external stimulus involved. It's just all happening in the mind. So then a big question can be raised. How do we know that this isn't just a dream? How can we really prove that? And science has no way. They talk about it and philosophize about it, and yet this is also a traditional, as I said, question of philosophy. But no one's come to any clear conclusion. So therefore, we talked about this theory of complementarity, which we took out of quantum mechanics, because the same duality there. In this quantum physics, they sort of reach the edge of perception. You know, they enter into the micro world and are studying these subatomic particles that are too small to see. They're studying by very indirect means through highly sophisticated apparatuses that detect these tiny things, you know, protons and neutrons and photons and so on and so forth. And there too, these are supposed to be the building blocks of this, you know, very substantial matter. But at some point, matter as we know it on that level just disappears. Matter as we know it no longer exists. And what you have are what are called wave particles, these things that act sometimes like little particles or sometimes like waves. And they defy all natural laws. They don't act according to gross physical objects at all. They have like their own set of special laws. And And this is, I read a remark, someone who writes about, a reporter who writes books about science. He said, many of these quantum physicists, by studying the subject matter, those who are more intelligent, more thoughtful, they become mystics or they join a religion or because they see the whole concept of matter, gross matter, it just doesn't exist there anymore. And what you're seeing also, what is it? It really can't be put into words. You see, the whole dialogue of quantum mechanics is not what quantum mechanics is about. That's all just like an allegory. It's all like symbolic of something else that can only be expressed in mathematics. And mathematics is purely mental. You see? So we come back to the same thing. Through the study of physics, starting with the study of physics, physics means the gross physical matter, we come again confronting this problem of the mind. What is the mind and what is the object of the mind? Where is the difference of it? And we raise this question of higher dimensions, that perhaps, as some scientists have proposed, this wave-particle duality, which very much has to do with perception. You see, they do these experiments. And it seems to them that material nature is reciprocating in some bizarre way. That we want to nail it down, whether it's wave or particle, one or the other. And they try all these tricky experiments and they think, now we're going to get it. Now it's going to be a particle. There's just no other way. There's no other way. Logically, all our logic comes to this conclusion that under this experiment, under these circumstances, we're going to show that matter is ultimately particles, and voila, what comes out is a wave. Just you know, as if Maya Devi is going like this, like, you're not under my control. You know, now it's a wave, and then they go, oh no! And then they try to think. And so whether on that level matter is appearing this way or that way, it has very much to do with the scientist's consciousness, you see, of what they're trying to prove, what they're trying to see there. So, and that also baffles them, and therefore some of them have come to this conclusion that we have to start counting consciousness as one of the fundamental elements of reality. We have to stop ignoring it, because obviously something is going on here involving consciousness. And we keep X-ing it out. We keep saying, no, there's only matter. You see? So, so what we've done so far is to show that all this is so baffling that even the four Kumaras, when they asked the question to Brahma about why is it like this, that the mind is so pervaded with sense objects. Because what do we think of when we think? We think of objects of the senses, or we think of words, which are just verbal expressions of things. So we think of things. We think of things we have experienced. I mean, how many here have thought of something they never experienced in some way or other? It's just, you know, you can't. Although we can say, someone can say, well, I've never experienced Krishna, but you have experienced Krishna to some degree. You've been among Krishna's devotees, you've chanted the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, you've experienced the ecstasy to some degree or other, you've seen the deity. So you know who Krishna is. We have not experienced Krishna in full, true. But we all have some idea, conception, experience of Krishna. So nobody can think of something that is just beyond their experience. That's totally unthinkable. And then on the other side, you see, there's this other thought experience to prove the futility of negationism, because that's the Mayavadi process. The Mayavadis, of course, this is actually what's behind the four Kumaras' questions, and we'll get to that, is actually an impersonal conception of what liberation is. because they're troubled with the fact that the mind is so pervaded with sense objects, and sense objects don't exist without the mind. If we didn't have a mind, we couldn't perceive sense objects. So they're asking their father, Lord Brahma, who created this whole system, that why is it like that if the purpose of life is liberation? Because they have this conception that liberation means to rid the mind of all material attachments, and that means in turn all perceptions that the mind might become attached to. But the mind is just flooded with perceptions. In fact, we can say the mind is a collection of perceptions. The mind has collected perceptions, birth after birth after birth after birth, and simply orders them into what is acceptable, what I like, what I want, what I enjoy, and what I don't enjoy. That's all, you see. But the mind is simply a big catalog of so many perceptions. So this is the problem the Kumaras are having. And so what's actually behind their question is negationism. And there's another nice thought experiment to show the futility of negationism as a means of ridding the mind of unwanted associations and attachments. And that is, that we ask you, all right, ladies and gentlemen, for the next 30 seconds, do not think of a polar bear with blue eyes. What do you immediately do? You think of a polar bear with blue eyes. Just as soon as the image is brought up, and it's such an interesting image, you can't help you. Your mind sort of like, hey, that's very far out. Polar bear with blue eyes. White bear, blue eyes. That would be very interesting to see. So 30 seconds go by, and that's all you can think of. So this is the problem. And we heard already that Brahma, even Lord Brahma, didn't have an answer. Although he's the most qualified jiva in the universe, he's the giver of the Vedas. But he has his own relationship with the material nature because he's the Rajoguna avatar. He's invested with the Rajoguna mode of passion, which means Raja, you see, is directly related in the Sanskrit language to the word Raga, which means attachment. So he, so to speak, created the universe. That's a secondary creation, technically called Visarga. That's the second subject of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Visarga, Brahma's creation. And we read that purport, in which, it's explained that despite Brahma's prayers to Krishna that may I not be bewildered, because he was afraid at the beginning that if I have to do this great work of creating the whole universe, I'll get attached, I'll get bewildered. And Krishna said, no, that doesn't have to happen, I'll protect you. But still, he gets bewildered from time to time, because he's a jiva and Maya is so strongly influencing the jiva. So this is the 11th canto, and we've already seen before in the Bhagavatam, those who have read the Bhagavatam through the 11th canto will have already seen several occasions in which Brahma unfortunately became bewildered by his own creation. You see, it's his own work. When this is just conditioning, you see, we do something and by doing it, we become attached to it, we become involved in it. And we think this is mine by right of labor. And we don't like it when someone else comes along and says, what is that? That's really poor work. That's really, you see, no, I did it. What do you do? Don't insult me. You see, this is my work. It's great. You don't understand. You see. So it's natural for us to become attached. And this goes all the way up even to Brahma himself. But Brahma is... nonetheless, someone asked Srila Prabhupada this question, because when reading the Bhagavatam, we see he does sometimes get involved in some embarrassing situations. So someone asked, how is it possible that he's in our line of Brahma Sampradaya, the first Acharya? Because he did this and he did that. And Prabhupada just cut off the questionnaire and said, whatever he may be, he is Acharya. Prabhupada didn't want to He didn't want to discuss it further than that. He said, I mean, because it's obvious. He's Brahman, not you. So who are you? You know, who are you to be questioning Lord Brahma? He's Brahma sitting at the lotus flower at the top of the universe, able to see everything in the whole universe as easy as we can see this hall here, things in this hall. He's able to see everything and everyone in the universe. His consciousness pervades everything. So he's in that position, and we're in this position, which is not very... Yes?
I just read this. The six sons of Devaki that were killed by Kamsa saw Brahma chasing his own daughter and looked upon him with abhorrence, and for that mistake, they were killed twice.
Yes.
And Devaki was the second time.
Yes. They had to undergo so much reaction. It was a great aparad. And that was Prabhupada's... That's why Prabhupada just dealt with it this so abruptly. He may be whatever he is, but he is Acharya. So, because he's in that position, then the Lord does not like to see his representative, the Adi Kavi, the original speaker of the Vedas, be embarrassed in this way for want of knowledge. So, when Brahma, the first of the Vedic sages, was stymied by his son's inquiry into the nature of the relationship and attachment, what did he do? This is what he did. This is also why he is Brahma. He fixed his mind upon the Lord. You see, an ordinary person, when we're asked a question that we can't answer, you know, we get embarrassed and we start to hate the person who asked the question. You're just trying to make me look bad, or we just feel ashamed of ourselves. Why am I so stupid? Or we wish that we had the book there that had the answer in it, but we can't find the book, or whatever. But he thinks of the Lord. He remembers Krishna. So, the Lord then appeared as the Hamsa avatar. And the reason he appeared, it's very nicely explained. He appeared to separate Brahma's consciousness from the modes of nature, just as a Hamsa, or swan, drinks milk alone from a blend of milk and water. You all know that example. So this is the reason why the Lord appeared in this form, as a beautiful, most beautiful, effulgent white swan. Because Brahma's consciousness had become attached to the modes of nature. So the Lord appeared there to separate his devotees' consciousness from the water, the milk of his devotees' consciousness from the water of material nature. So actually Hamsa avatar gives quite a dissertation, and it's extremely philosophical. This is one of the most, we could say, Vedantic portions of the Srimad Bhagavatam or Upanishad. It really reads like the Upanishads, Vedanta. It's very thick philosophy. So I've extracted from that two verses, and they read like this. He is speaking to Brahma, but especially he's speaking to the four Kumaras, because they're the ones who put this puzzling question to Lord Brahma. So he says, Manasa vachasa drishtya grihyate nyayar apindriyai aham eva na mato anyad iti budyadvam anjasa. And this means, within this world, whatever is perceived by the mind, you know, in other words, this is just what I was talking about, whatever the mind can perceive outside or perceive also inside, or whatever is perceived through speech, words, or directly through the senses, the eyes or other senses, all of that, Hamsa Avatar says, is me alone. It's just me. And nothing besides me. There's nothing besides me. And then he tells all of you, Lord Brahma, four Kumaras, please understand this by a straightforward analysis of the facts. So he's indicating here, especially to the Kumaras, that your question is not actually straightforward. There's something you've missed. It's sort of like when Krishna says to Arjuna, while speaking learned words, you're talking like a fool. You're using big words, but you're missing something very fundamental. And that fundamental thing, it's the same thing. We'll go on to hear what it is. That guneshu avishate cheto gunas chittasi cha prajaha jivasya deha ubhayam gunashchittu mad atmana. My dear sons, the mind has a natural proclivity to enter into the material sense objects. And similarly, the sense objects enter into the mind. So, at this point, Hamsa Avatar is agreeing with the four Kumaras. Yes, this is going on. He's not challenging them. He's not saying that you got that wrong, that you missed something in that department. Then he goes on to say what they missed. But both this material mind and the sense objects are merely designations that cover the spirit soul who is part and parcel of me. Now, do you see that point? Just like Krishna said to Arjuna, you're lamenting for what is not worthy of lamentation. You're lamenting over the body, but you are spirit soul. You are not the body. You are not subject to birth and death. Yet you're making all this hue and cry about what's going to happen if this battle is fought. How many near and dear relatives are going to die cruelly on this battlefield? That's what you're missing. And so you're giving all these reasons. You know, it's like the example you sometimes hear of the great mathematical equation. You know, that goes into advanced calculus, trigonometry, etc., so forth, all these elaborate forms of mathematics, but starts in the very beginning with a simple wrong calculation, like 1 plus 1 is 3, and then goes on from there. Everything else may be right, you know, and may be very elaborate and complicated, but the answer is going to be so far off the track, because in the very beginning there was a fundamental mistake. And so the fundamental mistake that the Kumaras were making is that they're identical, and this is natural for them because they are considered the greatest among the Gyanis. They're actually incarnations of the Lord's Gyana Shakti. So they're not ordinary Gyanis, they're the kind of Gyanis that Krishna says in the fourth chapter of Gita become very most dear to him because they did end up as devotees. But here, they're speaking as Gyanis would speak, identifying with the mind. Identifying the mind as the self, you see. And so how to purify this mind? If the mind's very nature is to be steeped in sense objects, how will the mind ever become purified? So Krishna's pointing out, yes, that problem is there for the mind and its relationship to the senses, but you've missed the point. You are not the mind. You're not the mind. The mind is just a designation. You see, the term is upadhi. And we have been talking about that in the Bhagavatam class so much. That Narada Muni says, this is the first sarvopadhi vinirmuktam. If one wants to be a devotee of Krishna, sarvopadhi vinir muktam, one has to become free of all upadhis, external designations. Naham vipro na chanara pitir napi vaishna shudro naham varni na chubhya pitir no na varastu yativa kintu prodnan nikila paramanana pranam ritam der gopi brartu para kamalior dasa daso anadasa. This is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. Naham vipro, I'm not a Brahmin. Na chanara pitir, I'm not a grihastha, I'm not a sannyasi, I'm not a member of any varna, any ashram, I'm none of these things. What am I? I'm simply the servant of the servant of the servant. In one translation, Prabhupada says, a million times removed. Servant of a servant of a servant of a servant of a servant. Say it over and over a million times. And then you get to the position, the mood of Mahaprabhu. Of those who are serving the lotus feet of the gopis. You see? So dasa, dasa, anudasa. That's my position. Very, very, very tiny. So, the tiny jiva, when he's off the track, when he finds that, oh, I can't be so tiny, I can't be so insignificant, I can't be serving a servant, and serving so many others, what is that? What? I have to be great. So as soon as he falls into that mistaken mentality, he begins to welcome upadis, because it's these upadis that make him great. You see? I have a PhD, you know, he goes to the university. And first he earns Bachelor of Science. BS. Now those from America know that BS can mean something else besides Bachelor of Science. The excrement of a bull, the bull stool. But there's another word that's used instead of stool, which is, we're not supposed to use that, these kind of words in these classes. But and then PhD, this is the last science degree, stands for piled higher and deeper. So you start with bull stool, and when it's piled higher and deeper, then you have PhD. So this is what the jiva actually does when he accepts upadis. It's just accepting more and more temporary, illusory, bodily designations. And he gets puffed up, of course. He feels very proud of himself. But by doing so, he sets himself up for a longer and harder fall. You see? This is what we do. The more we puff ourselves up, all we're doing is setting ourselves up for a longer and harder fall to our actual position. Like Srila Prabhupada, he gave this very nice example, I remember. This stuck in my mind when I was quite a new devotee. Because as often as a new devotee, I was assigned to the kitchen duties. But we had a very nice cook who was always playing Prabhupada's tapes in the kitchen. So I heard many, many lectures. And I remember hearing Srila Prabhupada say that he was talking about the importance of offering obeisances before the deity, before the spiritual master, before the devotees of the Lord. Offering obeisances. This nama in Sanskrit means, actually, I submit myself to you. I am yours. You see? When one offers obeisances and says, nama, begins his prayers with nama, he's like placing himself, it said, to fall, dandabats means like to fall as a rod. You see? So a rod is a tool, an instrument. You see, like here, walking stick. So when I often walk through the fields, because I visit Maharaj, he's usually over at the other school, supervising the construction there. Or I visit Subhekshana, who lives over there, whom I'm working with on certain projects. So then this becomes a very important instrument for me, this rod in my hand, because the ground is rough. And there are dogs out there. And the dogs sometimes, you know, they gang up on you, these Indian dogs. They come out of the underbrush in a pack and start nipping at your heels. So you got to show them. You just rarely have to even try to hit them. You just hold up the stick and they run off just when they see the stick. And sometimes also you meet cows, whole herd of cows coming back, and you know, they're filling the whole path. So you just put out the stick like this, and they, just by seeing the stick, they go around you. You don't even have to touch them, you just put the stick out. And So this is a very useful instrument. So dandavat means I'm your stick, use me. And when you say nama, this is what you're saying. You're declaring, I am yours. So you can pick me up, and you can use me, you can lean on me for support. You can go out in the field and poke through the underbrush with, you know, using me. You can use me to beat someone on the head if you have to. Whatever, but I am yours. That's the sense. So Prabhupada was explaining that the non-devotees, they do not like this. The non-devotees want to stand with their heads held up high, straight. You see, I'm standing on my own power. Others may be my servants, but I will never be anybody else's servant. But then Prabhupada said, then death comes along. And whack! You know, just like chopping them at the roots, and then they fall. Then they pay obeisances, their dandavats, to death. To Krishna, Krishna says, Mrityu sarva harashchaham, I am all devouring death. In that form they offer obeisances. But there they have no choice. It's no longer, you see, it's too late then. It's not an act of devotion anymore. It's just they've been forced to, by Krishna in that form, to admit that, I'm not God! Boom! And then their karma drags them away, you see. Too late. So, Lord Chaitanya is expressing this, that I am none of these designations that simply puff up the spirit soul. And every it's interesting that every designation that he mentions, these are designations out of Varna Ashram Dharma. So these are also simply upadis and can be coverings of Maya if one accepts them in the wrong way. We have been given by Srila Prabhupada the conception, actually the mission of establishing what Prabhupada termed Daivi Varnashram Dharma, God-centered Varnashram Dharma. So Daivi Varnashram Dharma, you see the regular, the Prakritic Varnashram Dharma, followed by the Karmis, led by these smarter Brahmins, ritualistic Brahmins, it's like a ladder. It's a hierarchy with Shudras at the bottom and Brahmins at the top. Whereas Daivi Varnashram Dharma you see in Goloka Vrindavan. In Goloka Vrindavan, in the Divya Vrindavan, in the spiritual world, there are also Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. Now why? You see, we might think, because Krishna says, Chaturvarnya Maya Shastram Guna Karma Vibhagasha, I have created these four Varnas out of my material energy. And there is a purpose to this varnashram, the gradual betterment of the soul through his occupational duty, which is meant to be done for me. And no matter what mode of nature he may appear, there is a place for him. And in 18th chapter he says, from any of those positions in varnashram dharma, the soul can achieve perfection if he does his duty properly for me. So we may think, alright, that's understandable for this material world, but why in Goloka Vrindavan? That's Daivi Varnashram Dharma. It's meant simply for the pleasure of the Lord, and therefore they're all parallel, you see. In Goloka Vrindavan, the so-called Shudra is parallel, on the same level as the Brahmana, because all are devotees of the Lord. They're all within the Leela of Krishna. So, we do have the information of from our acharyas of from the shastra of gradations of rasa, but actually from our position, that is practically speaking, we have to, if we're honest, if we're not already going down that wrong path to becoming sahajyas, then we honestly have to say that in our present position, this is something we can simply hear about and just accept, but not think that we understand. As soon as we start to think that we understand, we become offenders. And that was seen in Prabhupada's time on earth, when there was this group of devotees who became known, I don't know if they called themselves this, but throughout ISKCON they became known as the Gopi Bhava Club. And they used to meet in Los Angeles temple. They all lived there. And they would read from Prabhupada's books, no one else's books. Practically there were no other books like there are now. There are other books coming from other sources outside of ISKCON with descriptions of intimate leelas of Krishna. But at that time there was no such literature available. So they were just reading mainly Chaitanya Charitamrita and Krishna book. And we used to hear, I never talked with any of them myself, but we used to hear through the grapevine that some of them would sometimes say, oh, whenever I read Bhagavad Gita, I fall into Maya. It's too far down, you see. We should just read about the gopis and Krishna and in Prabhupada's books. So when Prabhupada heard about this, he was furious. I know from a devotee who was present at the time, who was traveling with Prabhupada, that when Prabhupada was told this, I'm not sure what time of day it was, but Prabhupada had just finished taking a shower. So he was putting on his tilak, and he couldn't put on his tilak for something like half an hour, because he was so disturbed. He kept starting and then he would stop, and one of the points that really infuriated him was that they say that the gopis are higher than Mother Yashoda. Now, of course we can read something to that effect in Srila Prabhupada's books, that there's this gradation of rasas, and the gopi bhava, the gopi Madhura rasa is the higher than Vatsalya rasa. But what that actually means, if we're honest, we don't know. Because at the same time, it is said that all of these devotees are situated in the absolute platform. That means all of them have their intimate and fully satisfying relationship with Krishna. Each one of them is fully satisfied in their relationship with Krishna. Therefore, they are completely Krishna conscious. And Krishna loves them in such a way that we cannot imagine. Just like we do this Mahasurusan Yajna, and I've been studying very much about Sudarshan Chakra because I worship Jagannath Sudarshan, so I find Sudarshana, he's very fascinating. When you go into, because there's not so much, he's there in the Bhagavatam, and there's not many verses about him, but what you read, particularly when Maharaj Ambarish is praising Lord Sudarshan, when he's begging him to spare Durvasa Muni, then you get a real glimpse into the position of Sudarshan, that he has this name, Achyuta Priya. Maharaj Ambarish addresses him as Achyuta Priya, which means Prabhupada, Achyuta Priya means dear to Lord Achyuta, but Prabhupada translates Achyuta Priya as something like, I don't remember the exact words, but something to the effect that the best friend of the Lord or the dearest associate of the Lord. Prabhupada is putting it in superlative terms, that the relationship between Sudarshana and the Lord is extremely confidential. It's a relationship of friendship. And then in studying other shlokas from like the Sri Sampradaya in South India, they worship Sudarshan. He's actually non-different from Lord Nrisimhadev. We worship Lord Nrisimhadev in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. We give so much importance to Lord Nrisimhadev. But actually, just as Lord Krishna appears as Krishna's devotee, Gauranga Mahaprabhu, so Lord Nrisimhadev also appears as Sudarshan Chakra, who is not typically understood as Vishnu Tattva, but rather one of the ornaments of the Lord. And he's, as a devotee, he's a giver of bhakti. And he has his own residence in Goloka Vrindavan, in Vrindavan. There's the Chakratirtha at Govardhan Manasi Ganga. So he's in Vrindavan too. And he's so I just recently read in Narada Pancharatra that this was so nice. He said that Krishna very rarely uses his Sudarshan weapon. Only rarely, only when he really has to. And the reason is that he doesn't like to send him away. He's so dear to him that he always likes him there. So just that short period of, you know, when he sends him off to cut someone's head off or burn up the city of Kashi, Lord Krishna feels so much separation. Oh, when will he come back? When will he come back? And then, oh, thank you, my dear devotee. Welcome back. So, in other words, these intimate rasas, the rasacharyas like Rupa Goswami have given these gradations. But if you can just understand, if someone is in that position where Krishna is missing you even for one moment, if he's like Sudarshan, we don't think of Sudarshan in Rasika Bhava terms at all, do we? We think, oh, he's the Lord's weapon, you know, cuts off the heads of the demons. But he has such an intimate relationship that Krishna doesn't like even for a second that he's away. And is always saving him, you know. All right, I'll use my bows and arrows, I'll use my sword, I'll use my mace, but not my Sudarshan. Well, it looks like I have to use my Sudarshan. Well, Sudarshan, I have to send you away. I'm really sorry. You'll have to go away. Please come back as soon as possible. Don't stay away too long. No, I won't, my Lord. I'll be right back. This will just take a second. Don't worry. Because he's described as the most formidable weapon in all of existence. There's no other weapon like Sudarshan. So then he flies off, kills the enemy, and comes back, and the Lord is so satisfied. So if you can just imagine to have such relationship with Krishna, even if your swarup is as a weapon of the Lord, but to be so dear to the Lord that he doesn't want to be separate from you, even for an instant, then what is this? This was what made Prabhupada so angry. They say, as if they understand that the gopis are higher than Mother Yashoda. What is this nonsense? And he was so furious, he couldn't put on his tilak for half an hour. So, anyone who thinks that they can by force enter into, say, gopi bhava, you know, the bhava of the gopis, then I'll just read certain select portions of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the songs of the gopis. I'll just read Ujjvala Nilamani. I'll just read Govinda Lilamrita. Just these portions about Radha, Krishna and the gopis. And then in this way I'll become a gopi. You see, this is nonsense. This is because even when you read what the Rasacharyas say about attaining this, they say the first requirement is humility. One has to have realized this dasa dasa anudasa. I'm the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant. Not think that I'm so qualified, I'm so special, I can just put my shoulder to the door of the gopi's dressing room and just barge in there and say, hey, you've got some kunkum for me, because here I am. You see? One of you want to fix my hair into a braid, you know? Oh, I guess I should shave first. There's this sect called the Saki Bekis. You see them in Vrindavan. And they're men, and they dress up like gopis. And it's so absurd, you know. It's so insanely ridiculous. You see these men with lipstick on, and sometimes, you know, a little bit of hair is still on the face. And they're walking around like this. And it's so crazy. But that's what they think. They think, I just act like a gopi, just practice, this becomes my sadhana, to practice living and talking and, you know, dressing and acting like a gopi, and I'll become a... This is... So Prabhupada, he hated it. He shut this group down immediately in no uncertain terms. So, sarvapari vinirmuktam. This is what is required. We have to get rid of all upadis, and the mind itself, the material mind. You have to keep this in mind. We started off this whole course by saying, yes, there is an original spiritual mind, and that is, we're not trying to kill the mind. It's not that we just, our aim is simply to rid ourselves of the mind entirely and become mindless. That is impersonalism. But rather we want to purify the mind. Just like it's said that when the Lord comes, He always comes, His mission is always twofold. To save His devotees, Pritranaya Sadnam, and Vinashaya Chatushkritam, to destroy the demons. So in previous ages, He would do that again with His weapons. Like He shows these four symbols of Narayan. So two, the Padma and the Shankha, are for to bless the devotees. When He entered Dwarka, as He approached Dwarka, He sounded His conch shell, Devadatta, so that all the residents would hear that the Lord has arrived. And so they all dropped whatever they were doing in great ecstasy, prepared to meet Him. And then He blesses them with the lotus, and His gada, His mace, and His disc are for the demons. So this is Krishna's mission whenever He comes. But in this age, since everyone more or less is a demon, although Prabhupada did say that 90% of the population is innocent, we are innocently demons, simply because we don't know any better. There's no Vedic knowledge, no Vedic culture. So everyone is acting without restraint, without restraining their senses. No one knows the reformatory principles that are to be practiced in human life. Everyone has more or less become a two-legged animal. So by default, most of the population is demoniac. But yet Prabhupada said 90% are innocent. In other words, they don't like... They're doing bad things, cruel things, nasty things out of ignorance. And to the degree that they have some knowledge, some basic moral knowledge from some mundane religion, moral teachings, to that degree, they try to be good. They know that it's better to be good, at least. They have some yearning, at least, to be good people, within the very limited definitions of what is good. So, therefore there's still law, you see. There's still such a thing as crimes. I mean, if things are going to come to that point in Kali Yuga, in the future, where there will be no more law, and there will be no more definition of what is a crime and what is a good act, because the people will really just be wild, without any, just barbarians, without any sense of civilization at all. But still today, there's this, at least monomaya, on the monomaya mental platform, there's still some distinction between good and bad. And most people would prefer to be good. So Lord Chaitanya, as Lord Nityananda reminded him, if you kill Jagai Madai, you have to kill everybody. Because more or less everyone is doing these same things. But you didn't come here to kill them, you came here to save them. But it still means killing the demoniac mentality, but not killing the mind. Not killing the mind, but the mind that is acting wrongly, the mind that is functioning wrong, the crazy mind. That crazy mind, as I defined the five basic points of this course, so one of the points is, the last point is that what we call the material mind is in essence the state of material attraction. That's what has to be killed. This thing that's always pulling at our heart. You see, actually this is an offense. Despite having heard so many instructions on the matter, despite chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, we still find that tug in the heart towards nice material sense objects. You see? Still that tendency is there. So when that is anyabhilashata shunyam, when all other desires except the desire to serve Krishna shunyam are annihilated, that is a literal translation of the word shunyam, to make void, to annihilate. If you look at the English word annihilate, the root is nihil. You see, like a nihilist is just another term for a voidist. Nihilist. So annihilate, to make void. Anyabhilashata shunyam. So all other desires except the desire to serve Krishna should be made void. Then that mind is your best friend. It's not about killing the mind. It's about killing the non-Krishna, the pratikul, because in the same verse, anukul pratikul. Anukul yena Krishna anushilanam. And then pratikulasya varjanam. So that which is pratikul, unfavorable for devotional service, that we have to get rid of. That has to be removed. And what is anukul, favorable for devotional service, and certainly a mind that is attached to Krishna, that is most favorable. Because again, we need this mind. If we are to taste the rasa, Srila Prabhupada got the very, he explained, he took the very term Krishna consciousness from a verse by Srila Rupa Goswami, Krishna rasa bhavita, which begins with these words, Krishna rasa bhavita, which means the state of being immersed in Krishna bhakti rasa. Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita. Yes, Krishna bhakti rasa bhavita. So the state of being immersed, in the nectar of Krishna bhakti rasa, that is Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada took the very phrase Krishna consciousness from that. The mind's being absorbed in the nectar of always hearing and chanting and remembering about the Lord. And that was the vision that Srila Prabhupada had for this movement. That is what Prabhupada expects us to be doing. That's the purpose of this Gaura Purnima festival, that in this transcendental dham, which is so conducive to the holy name because this is Lord Chaitanya's own abode, that we all come together and we just simply engage in Nam Sankirtan before their lordship, Sri Sri Radha Madhav, Sri Panchatattva, Sri Palad Narsingha, and go around on the Gaura Mandal Bhumi Parikram, get the blessings of all the different forms of the Lord. Like we were talking about Sudarshan giving bhakti, so also one important place here at Nisringapalli, which is visited every year, that's where Lord Nisringadev gives bhakti. Ordinarily it is said that Lord Nisringadev doesn't give bhakti. That's why in South India they have this deity of Nisringadev and Sudarshan back to back. We have one upstairs. So you worship Lord Nisringadev as the Lord, and then you turn the deity around and you worship Sudarshan and you beg him for bhakti. That may I have devotion to the Lord so that my service may become better and better. So, but here at Nisringapalli in Mayapur, Lord Nisringadev, in that form, he's giving bhakti. So this is a very, very special place. Therefore it's called Audarya Dham. Audarya Dham. Here the Lord shows his munificence. He's very free with blessing his devotees, especially if they come from far away, taking much trouble to come here. Then he's very, very free to bless you with the rarest gift of all. So, Hamsa avatar then, he begins by reminding the Kumaras that you're not the body, you're not the mind, you're not the sense object, so what are you worried about this so much for? This is simply your attachment to Maya.
Maharaj,
yes.
Can I break a rule by asking you a question?
Go ahead.
I've been following this, and it seems to me that the Hamsa avatars answer is circular. The Kumara's question is, how do we do this? This is our brother attached. And Hamsa's avatar's answer is circular. He's saying, well, you're not really attached, you only seem to be attached. But that begs the question, I think.
No, because we haven't finished the topic. Actually, we've already given a little insight in the second verse. My dear sons, the mind is a natural proclivity to enter the material sense objects, and similarly the sense object enters the mind. But both this material mind and sense objects are merely designations that cover the spirit soul, who is part and parcel of me. The topic of this chapter is what? Relationship and attachment. By that last phrase, Hamsa Avatar is saying, you should become related and attached to me, instead of being related and attached to your designations of mind and senses. You see? So that was the next section, that everyone relates to Krishna only. Unfortunately, 5:30 is creeping up on us right now. So tomorrow we'll go into that in detail. That actually, everyone, even now, no matter what consciousness we're in, we are only relating to Krishna. That is the reality. That is the reality. And all these problems, you know, the human problem, what do they say? The human predicament. You know, they like it's this great burden that's fallen out of the sky upon us poor human beings. The human predicament, you know. All the human problems. Oh, this great burden on our back as human beings. This is all the product of illusory misidentification. We're trying to have a relationship with something that we cannot have a relationship with to begin with, because it is Maya. It is not even there. You know, as I say, the scientists, they study matter, and then finally the conclusion is, I have one book in my collection upstairs in the library. Two of the top scientists have written a book called The Matter Myth. They've used science to prove that matter doesn't even exist. It's the negationist process, but I mean, this is their conclusion. We go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and finally matter just disappears. So what are we, you know, what are we doing? What is science all about? What are we all doing as human beings? That's the question they raise. Their conclusion is practically that there's only consciousness, and that's a fact, but there's consciousness of two orders. The conclusion is all right as a first step, but then there's danger of becoming a Mayavadi. You see, consciousness meaning the consciousness of oneness. There's only one consciousness, one great consciousness, the all-pervading Brahman. That's a mistake too, you see. No, there is actually a place for relationship and attachment. These are not ultimately illusions, as the Mayavadis would say, because everything is really only one. There are two orders of consciousness, Vibhu and Anu, the supreme and the tiny, 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 tiny spirit soul, 1/10,000th the tip of a hair in size. And there naturally, Prabhupada explains in teachings of Lord Chaitanya, there's a natural attraction, because one is so great, he's fascinated with the one who's so small. And the one who's so small is fascinated with the one who's so great. So there's a natural draw between the two. And so this is what Hamsa Avatar. And we will read more of Hamsa Avatar's reply to the Kumaras tomorrow. And then also go into the third canto. We'll see where Devahuti has actually asked a very similar question as the one that the Hamsa Avatars asked. It's practically the same question, just in different vocabulary. And then Prabhupada points out the fault. There's a fault behind this question, and it's the fault of impersonalism. The very fact that the question comes up in this way, and is asked in this way, is pointing out a defect in the questioner. And this is what the Hamsa Avatar is getting at. What he's saying in effect is, you've forgotten all about me, and your relationship with me. And you're just hung up in matter, in the subtle regions of matter, because you're jnanis. You're jnanis, so you're very exalted, you're very nice young boys. Of course, they're old boys, millions of years old, but they look like boys. You're very nice boy sages and all that. You're my Jnana Shakti personified, but it seems you've forgotten about me. And now you're just worried about your mind and the relationship of your mind to the senses and the senses to the mind. And this is just Maya. You see? The Prabhupada talks about getting entangled in the complexities of the material energy. So as I've said several times, these complexities extend outward into the world, into so many things, but actually, what was that? Remember that quote?